Northwestern Medicine, relentless in their pursuit of better health care. Learn more at nm.org/better.
It's 9:40 and time for the Week in Health. Dr. Jack Silver joining us, the Medical Director, Emergency Medicine, Northwestern's Kishwaukee Hospital. Good morning to you, Dr. Silver. How are you, my friend?
Good morning, Dean. Good to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, too. Wanted to start off with something that I'm noticing with a lot of people, and then I looked it up and found that it is actually widespread. That is walking pneumonia. Can you explain the difference between pneumonia and walking pneumonia?
Sure. I mean, it's all bacteria or viruses that get into the lungs and cause infection. But, you know, when you drill down into the type of germs that cause these diseases, like pneumonia, they're a little bit different. And walking pneumonia doesn't tend to affect people in such a severe way as what you think of a typical bacterial pneumonia, where a piece of the lung gets filled up with pus, and some folks end up in the hospital and sick for a long time. But it is, you know, significant, and certainly it can cause you to miss work, or if you're a child, to miss school. But it's out there, and certainly, you know, like everything else that we talk about with illnesses, if you're really on the extremes of the age spectrum, less than 2 or older than 65, or you've got chronic medical conditions, like COPD or heart failure, or you have a weakened immune system, taking immune suppressant meds, or you have cancer, those folks are going to be more susceptible.
What are symptoms that you might have walking pneumonia?
Sure. So a lot of it overlaps with symptoms that you might ascribe to the common cold or the flu or COVID. So a sore throat, fatigue, certainly chest pain and cough. Although not every person will have a cough, many children will just present with a bellyache. And we can talk about that a little bit more if you'd like, but also headache and even sneezing, and certainly a low-grade fever.
Wow, so it's very much cold-like symptoms with that can be kind of misleading for people.
That's correct, yes. That's why it's really important if you're feeling run down and, you know, you've got more than a few symptoms that are concerning, particularly shortness of breath or you're coughing, a good idea to have that looked at.
Okay, what is the treatment? I know for pneumonia, they pump you up full of antibiotics. Is that also the case with walking pneumonia?
Absolutely. So if you are diagnosed with the quote-unquote walking pneumonia, there's some great medications out there that are safe for adults and for kids, and the good news is you can take them by mouth, and they work very well. So it's very treatable. And again, you're very unlikely to become seriously ill, but it's just important to catch it early on in the process.
Is this something that is contagious? If somebody has it, should family members, friends who are in close physical proximity be concerned?
Yeah, it is actually pretty darn contagious. And so, you know, like all the other respiratory diseases, whether it's COVID or flu or RSV, if you're coughing and you don't feel good, wear a mask when you're out in public, and you will hopefully prevent a few other folks from getting sick like you.
Actually, a texter on the subject from the 708 asks, how long are you contagious after completing antibiotics for pneumonia?
Oh, that is a great question. I think nobody knows the exact answer. But I think what I tell people when they come into the emergency department is a safe bet is that you've been greater than 24 hours after your last fever and you're no longer coughing or generating particles from your nose or mouth that are going out into the air.
Okay. All right. Well, that's a good guideline to follow with this. Are you seeing people who are coming in, are you seeing it more in the emergency room?
we are seeing a significant bump in this illness pattern. So it's definitely out there now, and it's definitely causing disease.
Yeah, and what's the latest on the taking of antibiotics? It used to be back in the day, you know, doctors were handing them out like candy. And now you can barely get your doctor to prescribe an antibiotic. Right. What's the latest on all of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're in a phase where any hospital that you go to work in as a physician, they're going to have an antibiotic stewardship program, and that's the buzzword amongst the medical personnel. But for the average Joe who doesn't know anything about medicine and just is curious, what's the deal? The deal is that we started to see significant antibiotic resistance 15 to 20 years ago, and became concerned that if we continue to throw out antibiotics in the settings of viruses, for instance, then all you're doing is you're helping the bacteria that aren't currently causing disease in your body mutate to the antibiotics, so they see it. They're just constantly generating new versions of themselves. They're constantly replicating in your body, and you're introducing an opportunity for them to replicate into a mutation. And then the next time you actually need that antibiotic for strep throat or strep pneumonia or whatever the case is, well, now you've got a bunch of germs that are well-tuned to fight off that drug, and it's no longer effective. Mm. And we're seeing that now, you know, because this plays out in healthcare settings across the world every day. And so the population of bugs out there in the world are getting stronger and stronger the more we use these drugs when we shouldn't be. So that's, you know, one big reason. And then another reason is simply that it can cause bad side effects. There's a diarrheal illness called C. difficile diarrhea, and not to get into the gross specifics of it, but it can be lethal, and it can impact people's lives forever, totally changing the way their gut works. And people have chronic diarrhea for life after developing this disease and other health issues. And so that is all tied to many antibiotics can cause that type of diarrhea. And I'm sure some of your listeners have even experienced that personally. So that's a second very significant reason to hold back on the antibiotics if you don't need to. And then lastly is allergic reactions. So with allergies, they're often tied to drugs, and they get more severe the more often you have them. And so if I'm going to have a rash, the first time I take a penicillin, and then the next time I take it, I'm going to have full-blown life-threatening anaphylaxis. Well, I want to try and save it for when I really need it. And if I have a rash, well, then I take it off my list, but at least I've used it sparingly. So there's a lot of reasons, a lot of really good reasons why we don't, like you say, throw it out like candy.
But are they developing new antibiotics the way they did with COVID vaccines, as the disease itself changed and morphed based on the way we were fighting it? New vaccines were developed. Are we not doing that with antibiotics?
You know, it's mind blowing to me why we haven't shifted into that preventative mode. Because we know that the number of effective antibiotics is dwindling, and we're seeing more and more severe hospital-based infections, funguses and bacteria and all manner of diseases. What we did with the vaccine for COVID was a generational approach to fighting back against the germs, and it will be, I think, the story of humankind, of how we adjust and adapt to the pathogens in our environment. Now, of course, I'm biased. I'm a physician, and that's my world. But I truly believe that is the existential fight of humanity, is against the germs.
Yeah.
So, yes, it would 100,000% be in our best interest to be doing this. But it all comes down to the money and the insurance companies and the drug developers. And if people can't get paid to do the R&D, they're not going to do it.
Seems like
it all comes down to finances.
Yeah, it seems like there would be a lot of money involved in creating something like that, just like the pharmaceutical money's made a boatload of money on all the different COVID vaccines. Let me take a break. When we come back, more questions, comments for Dr. Jeremy Silver, 312-981-7200, next on WGN. 9:54, back with Dr. Jeremy Silver, Director of Emergency Medicine, Northwestern's Kishwaukee Hospital. The American AHA has put out some new guidelines for stroke. Doctor, I wonder if you could kind of brush over that a little bit so we're all up to date on that.
Yeah, Dean, I'm pretty happy about this. I think the great part of these new recommendations, and they come out every few years, is a real emphasis on things that people can actually do something about as opposed to genetics or other factors. And so what they've done is they've actually identified life's essential eight cardiovascular health metrics. So the eight things that that you and I can do to impact our risk for stroke. And those eight things include healthy nutrition. Particularly, they recommend the Mediterranean diet, which you and I have talked about many times.
Opa.
Regular physical activity, which is terrific. And that's, 75 minutes of vigorous exercise or 150 minutes of moderate exercise, which you could consider walking multiple days a week. Avoiding tobacco, that's a pretty clear one, but it's nice to remind folks that if you are still smoking, cutting down is going to help you decrease your stroke risk. Getting a healthy amount of sleep, that's 7 to 8 hours a night for most people. Controlling your weight, well, that's easier said than done, but it's certainly nice to remember that it's something we can control. And then things like cholesterol, blood pressure, and blood sugar, which to an extent, come back to diet in terms of salt intake, fat intake, and sugar intake. So, that's all really helpful stuff. And I think, if the more we can educate people on the things that they can do, then, drugs and other things can kind of come into the picture after that.
Yeah, all things that we've heard before, but always good to remind us. A caller, Arlene, said she just had hip surgery. She's on antibiotics. Does she have to stay on them for the rest of her life?
Unless there's some very unique reason why they might have been prescribed, some folks are on antibiotics for life for various conditions, and I don't know her specific situation. But in the setting of a hip surgery, generally the antibiotics after surgery do not last for life, no.
Okay, it's just it's almost to prevent any kind of infection, I would guess, right?
Correct, yep.
Okay. Once again, Dr. Dean with the answers, even though he knows nothing about anything. Dr. Jeremy Silver, Director of Emergency Medicine at Kishwaukee Hospital. Have a great Sunday, Doctor. We'll talk with you soon. Thank you.
Same to you, sir. Thank you.